This is Deborah Beck, professor of ancient Greek literature in the Department of Classics at the University of Texas at Austin. My students and I are excited to welcome you to our podcast, Musings in Greek Literature. Welcome to season 3 of Musings in Greek Literature. Our focus this season is Apollonius's Argonautica, whose title is translated into English in various ways, including The Voyage of the Argo, Jason and the Golden Fleece, Jason and the Argonauts. It's the story of Jason and his band of heroes, the Argonauts, so-called because their boat is named the Argo, as they sail across the oceans of the known world in quest of the Golden Fleece, which they eventually capture in the exotic land of Colchis, where they also become entangled with the magical princess Medea. But at the same time, and just as much, it's the exciting voyage of Apollonius, the epic poet, through the waters of poetry over the centuries. Welcome to episode 1. Today we're talking about book 1 of the Argonautica and how it sets us up for what to expect in the rest of the poem. We're going to talk a lot about the prologue, which, as in most epic poems, has a lot to do with telling us what the whole rest of the poem is going to be like, both in what it says and what it does not say, and also in how it says it. We're then going to talk about some larger themes and some specific things that happen in book 1 that are particularly fun and interesting for us to think with. I am very excited today to be joined by Bill Ferris. Hi, Bill. Do you want to say hello to our audience and say a little bit about yourself?
Hi. Thank you, Dr. Beck. I'm a grad student at UT right now in the classics department, and I'm currently writing a dissertation on Apollonius and Tisian.
Great. So Bill knows a lot about Apollonius. In addition to being a researcher on Apollonius, he's also teaching a course right now that has some Apollonius in it. So we're both looking forward to thinking about Apollonius as teachers and as researchers. So let's start off with the first 22 verses of the poem, which tell us a lot about what Apollonius thinks his poem is about. It also introduces us to Apollonius himself, the narrator, as a character in the poem, and narration as part of what the poem is about, in addition to the story of Jason and the Argonauts sailing far away from their Greek home and encountering all kinds of non-Greek people who tell us various interesting things about what it means to be Greek and about the intellectual world of the 3rd century BCE, in which Greeks were having more contact than ever before with all kinds of people who lived far away from them and had all kinds of unfamiliar customs and so forth. And it resulted in this intellectual ferment where there were all these new scientific disciplines and ways of thinking about the world that arose in part in order to try to understand all this new knowledge that was streaming into the Greek world because of their contact with all of these people. So the first 4 verses of the poem tell us an enormous amount, even though they're very short. So Apollonius, the very first word is begin, Archamenos seo, beginning with you, Phoebus, that is Apollo. I shall recall the famous deeds of men born long ago, who at the command of King Peleus sailed the well-benched Argo through the mouth of the Black Sea and between the Chionean rocks to fetch the Golden Fleece. Now, let me just say, before we continue, Bill and I are using William Race's text and translation of the Argonautica that was published by the Loeb Classical Library through Harvard University Press. So Professor Race, thank you for this really awesome edition, which makes the life of every reader and scholar of Apollonius much more pleasant. So in these verses, it's clear that the process of storytelling is as important to setting the stage as what the story is about. And so whereas the Iliad or the Odyssey starts out by simply saying, Muse, tell me the story. In this introduction, the poet names himself, the narrator names themselves as the person telling the story. I will recall. And the words at the beginning of the first verse and the second verse are verbs of storytelling that say, hello, I am the storyteller and here's what we're going to do. So both the content and the structure is really telling us that the narrator, the poet, the process of poetry is as much what we're doing here as telling a story about Jason going on an exciting trip. To the extent that it's these verses are telling us what the story's about, it's about sailing around at the command of King Pelias. But Bill, is that how you would summarize the poem? I mean, it's striking to me what is not here as much as what is here.
Yeah, for instance, I think a fun way to look at it is to think about a main character who doesn't get mentioned, i.e. Medea.
Absolutely.
And I think a place where that's really in the text that's fun to look at is line 7, the line before this, Pelias. I'll just read the English starting at line 5. For such was the oracle that Pelias heard, that a horrible fate awaited him in the future, to perish through the designs of that man whom he would see coming from the people with only one sandal. And I wanted to look at that bit in the English, through the designs of that man. In the Greek, it's the end of line 7, hoop enesiesi damenai. What's strange is we know that Pelias is going to have some horrible fate that has something to do with Jason, but we don't know what Jason's role in it is. Apollonius is probably expecting a readership that has an idea that Medea has something to do with Pelias's unfortunate fate. But Apollonius isn't telling us anything about that right now.
No, I totally agree with that. To me, one of the things that's striking about Jason's actions in this sort of, as it were, middle section of the prologue, which is verses 5 to 17, telling us about how the story began happening, essentially. Jason is really almost like an accidental, very reactive hero in this, well, not even really a hero at all. All he does is he kind of gets entangled in the oracle that is about Pelias. It's not an oracle about him. It's about somebody else. It doesn't mention him by name. It just says some guy whose shoe fell off. So the only thing that Jason actually does is he crosses a river swollen in the winter, and then his shoe falls off. So that's kind of all that happens. And really the action is driven by other people. And so on the one hand, this is kind of like, well, that's lame. But at the same time, I think it's also helping us to start getting a sense of what Jason is going to be like as a hero in the Argonautica. He does tend to be a fairly reactive person, especially at the beginning. And his heroic qualities are things that would not be visibly or clearly identified as heroic in earlier, and especially in Homeric epic. So instead of in the Iliad, for example, where the very beginning of the poem has two of the main characters getting into a fight in the prologue, where the main characters are number one, very central, and number two, they're really doing something. This is not that. This is a very different kind of introduction of the hero.
Or if you even think of feet, for instance, Achilles is well known in the Iliad for being podus ocus, swift-footed. But at least in the oracle, we know that Pelias is looking for, in line 7, oiopedilon man, a guy mm-hmm. with one shoe on.
One shoe,
which is just silly looking, in fact. Yeah. So it seems not only what you wouldn't look for in a... It's like the exact opposite of, say, an Achilles, some guy who... bumbling around, got his shoe stuck in the mud.
Yeah. Yep, absolutely. So then after this pretty underwhelming introduction of Jason, if we look at the end of the prologue in verses 18 to 20, it once again highlights the storyteller and the process of storytelling as fundamental to what the prologue and the whole poem is about. And you know, the common classical epic compositional technique of ring composition, where you repeat the same idea at the beginning and the end of something in order both to emphasize that idea and also to create a unity or a unit of what's enclosed by that structure, I think is really also working here to underline the importance of storytelling and the storyteller as part of what the prologue is about. So it's common in an epic prologue to help the reader or the audience to understand where your particular epic fits into a larger kind of tapestry of stories about the particular character or the Trojan War or whatever that you're talking about. But what Apollonius is doing here really stands out. He's helping you to understand where his story fits into a multitude of stories told by other tellers about these events, which is not the same thing. So what Apollonius is, what Apollonius says is, as for the ship, and ship is the first word of this last chunk of the prologue, Neia, the songs of former bards still tell how Argus built it according to Athena's instructions. But now I wish to relate the lineage and names of the heroes, their journeys on the vast sea, and all they did as they wandered. And may the muses be some word that it's not clear what it means of my song. Musaid hufo phaetoris aen aoides. So there's a word at the end of line 18 and the end of line 22. There's a word that means song or singing, which is how the Greeks referred to poetry. So even within this, you know, little end of the prologue, we're really highlighting the idea of song. And again, the poet is calling attention to himself as the driver of the poem. So the middle, line 20, he says, ego, I am doing this thing. And in Greek, you don't need that pronoun in order to make it clear that it that the speaking voice is telling you this. If they left out that word I, it would still be clear. He says, I'm telling you what this is all about. So the poem, I think, at the very beginning is just going out of its way over and over and over again. First of all, to bring forward that the process of storytelling and the presence of the narrator is going to be central. And that's a big contrast to Homeric epic in particular, which is something that Apollonius is constantly expecting his readers to be familiar with and to be thinking about. The Homeric narrator, by contrast with Apollonius, is very retiring and hardly ever refers explicitly to themselves. So this narrator is doing something very different, saying, I'm awesome. Watch me tell a story. Isn't this great? So the muses, who are usually at the beginning of an epic prologue and usually the drivers of the storytelling process, instead are this kind of showing up at the end where the narrator hopes that the muses are going to interpret the song, inspire the song. What this word hypophator means is a subject of some disagreement. So after this opening, the rest of book one describes part of the Argonauts' journey from their home in Iolcos to Colchis, which is on the Black Sea. In book three, they'll spend the whole of book three in Colchis, where they meet up with Medea and try to get the Golden Fleece. And this is the part of the Argonautica that is the most widely read today and the most familiar to people. Before they leave Greece, though, they decide who should lead the expedition, which is a very strange thing for someone familiar with Homeric epic, where who the leader is, everybody wants to be the leader and they're kind of, you know, assuming they're the leader unless for some reason they can't do that. And Jason is not like that. Their first port of call is in Lemnos, which we're gonna talk about in a minute. They then stay with King Cyzicus, which is a very tragic incident because they, after having a very pleasant stay with him, where he serves as their host, they accidentally kill him. How do you accidentally kill people? Well, that's a whole other story. We're not going to talk about that. They're very upset. The people of Cyzicus are very upset. That's not a great story. Then at the end of book one, they make a pit stop and they leave Heracles behind. So the absence of Heracles then colors the rest of the voyage. So Bill, I know you've thought a lot about the Lemnian women in the context of teaching it in your class this semester. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so my students were really good at helping me think about what Dr. Beck has just been talking about Apollonius bringing forth the narrator as a narrator to make readers think about narration. Because the way my students approached this poem, especially the Lemnos episode, was, what's going on? There's so many tangents. I don't know what's important. So
my students have the same reaction. Yeah. My students are like, there's too many names. How do I know which ones are important? I'm so overwhelmed.
Then honestly, I'm like that too, especially at first.
Yeah. Me too. Absolutely. I think everybody's like that, except people that have been reading Apollonius for so long that they forget what it's like to come to it new and fresh for the first time.
Yeah. I kind of wish I could go back in a way. Maybe what we can look at here is passages, or let's say ways in which Apollonius is playing with being a narrator in the Lemnos episode. So for instance, if you look at line 609, there's a passage from 609 to about 639 which is the narrator introducing that the Argonauts have just landed on this island of Lemnos, where it happens that there are no men on the island. And why is this? Because the narrator tells us that the women, well, let's say this, the men all fell in love with Thracian women that they had captured, and then the Lemnian women kill all their husbands. Oh, and by the way, all the male children too on the island. And he brings it, the narrator brings it out forward, because at the next section, or I think it's at the end of the section I mentioned towards 639 or so, the women see the Argonauts approaching their island and they're like, oh shoot, people might want to come fight us. Maybe it's the Thracians whose women we've all killed. What are we going to do? But one thing here that I think that Apollonius is playing with narration, if you look at line 615, so there's a sentence starts about 614 before that in the Greek, epe kolos. Mm-hmm. For the terrible wrath of Cyprus, Cyprus was of Aphrodite, was afflicting them because they had for a long time deprived her of honors. So this is a little statement by the narrator talking about how the gods are involved. But my students asked this question, who is the them in the English? Was mm-hmm. it afflicting them? And I've checked, I think it's in J.J. Klaus's book, The Best of the Argonauts. He has a nice footnote where he talks about scholars are divided. Is this the men on Lemnos who mm-hmm. Aphrodite got mad at, or the women? And I wonder if that's something that the narrator is doing here, just not actually being very precise there. It confuses us. So playing with that narration a little more, if you skip later in the story, so just to sum up, the women have a council, almost like democratic, who wants to speak in our assembly, and they decide, well, let's let the Argonauts come and stay with us for a while, with the intent of hopefully procreating, I suppose we should say, and repopulating the island. But if you look ahead to 793, this is where Jason finally comes and meets Hypsipyle, who's the queen of Lemnos, who has taken over. Her father, Thoas, had been the king, and now she's taken over his place. What the narrator does here is re-narrates the backstory to how all the men are off the island in the voice of Hypsipyle to Jason, starting at line 793 and ending at line 833.
Right.
But the narrator, go ahead.
So what we're getting here, instead of, the beginning of the story, the narrator says, okay, people, here's what actually happened. Because the convention is that the things that are told to you by the third person narrator are supposedly, usually conventionally more reliable than the things that characters say, because characters have their own, you know, axe to grind and may slant a particular story that they're telling to make themselves look good or not make themselves not look too bad or whatever. So we know a certain version of the story from the narrator's description before we get here. And now here's Hypsipyle telling the strangers about her people. And we have a really interesting opportunity to see what Hypsipyle wants to tell them or not tell them, because we've already heard from the narrator about what the quote unquote true story actually is about how this all came about. So now we get this is a great way for us to kind of understand what makes Hypsipyle tick.
Yeah. And in fact, the narrator brings that out specifically by saying right after the end of the speech, line 834, she spoke, glossing over what act of murder had been carried out against the men. So it'd be one thing if we were just left as readers to note ourselves that she has a different story, but the narrator is bashing us over the head with that.
That's fantastic. And he's also bashing us over the head, because that word glossing over, amaldunusa, that is not a common word at all. So I'm guessing that a reader just kind of going along is like, wait a minute, what? So the word choice, as is so often the case with Apollonius, he's using unusual words to really draw your attention to things that he wants you to notice. He does that all the time. He does it a lot, for example, with words that only appear once in Homeric epic. lots and lots of those words, which were very interesting to ancient scholars, appear in Apollonius. And so all different kinds of words that are unusual or weird or rare are going to appear in Apollonius to describe emotions, behavior, events that are particularly important for one reason or another.
Yeah. Yeah, I would, such a strange, it sounds strange to Amaldunus.
Yeah.
So maybe another thing we could look to, because we've just been talking about, so one story narrated and Hypsipyle tells it a different way, but the Limnos episode, Apollonius kind of pushes this game with narration more at a couple different places in while the Argonauts are at Limnos. So if we go back to line 703, this is after the women have had their assembly and they need to send a messenger to the Argonauts to say, hey, come here. Hypsipyle gives the messenger Iphinoe very precise words. I'm going to read them in English now. Please go, Iphinoe, and entreat that man, Jason, whoever it is that leads the expedition, to come to my palace so that I may tell him a decision of the people that will please his heart. And as for the men themselves, invite them, if they wish, to enter the land and city confidently as friends. So what's interesting from the narration point here is that if you look down to line 712, this is where Iphinoe has come to the Argonauts and is telling them what seems to be exactly what Hypsipyle told her to tell them, with verb persons change to meet the grammar, because she's now saying you instead of third person, it's second person. But Iphinoe changes a word. So where in the English on line 707, Hypsipyle had said, tell them to come to the city confidently, which in Greek, tharsaleos, boldly, Iphinoe, the messenger, says, you can come immediately, autika, on line 716. So we even have another instance of Hypsipyle telling her messenger to say something, and the messenger decides, well, maybe that's not the best way to put it, and decides to change it up a little bit to show us the freedom of somebody reporting a story has and changing the story.
Well, and that's fascinating in a couple different ways. First of all, because Homeric narrators don't have that freedom, and Apollonius is constantly expecting a readership that's very, very well versed in Homeric norms of and conventions, such as that a messenger simply directly repeats what they were told to say. And the other thing I think that's really striking here is that that word change is the only word in the whole thing that's changed. Up until that point, you would imagine that you were in a Homeric narrator speech where everything is just the same as it was when the person gave you the message, and then you give the message and then the person responds and you bring that back. But this one word gets changed, and that really highlights the disputed nature of how the Argonauts should respond to this invitation. So I just love that.
And it's fun to look at the meter too, to see what's changed. In 707, it's thar salat os. Dun, da, da, dun. And in 716, au tika noon, immediately, right now. Yeah. And it's dun, da, da, dun. It's the exact same rhythm, too. Kind of brings that difference out.
Great. Bill, you spoke earlier in the episode about one of the students' reactions to this poem when you taught it in your class, that they had a lot of trouble with how much information there is and how to tell the difference between what's really important and what's not important, or less important, or differently important. And I have had the same experience with my students. We both had the same experience as readers of Apollonius. So how do you take away the lessons or the experiences that you have with your students with this particular kind of information overload? What do you learn from that about information overload more generally? Because I think that's something that readers or consumers of information in any format struggle with in any class about anything, or for that matter, anybody reading the newspaper. I mean, I still read a paper newspaper. I know that hardly anybody does that, but taking in the news, we have the same kind of feeling that there's just so much information out there and we're overwhelmed. So what have you learned from sort of helping your students deal with this challenge about this much more pervasive and fundamental question of how do you manage the amount of information that you're getting from a very information-rich source?
So I think the first one, I mean, particularly for a poem like this with a story, is, but more generally about other things, is to figure out what's most important. And so maybe the base layer for reading a poem like this is simply, what's the plot? What's happening? What happens to the characters? What are they trying to do? And the other part after you, or along with trying to figure out just what the plot is to accept the fact that to really get into a book like this, you need to reread. And that becomes part of not only how to do this, but the pleasure of it is to go back and relook over the details. So with my students, I tend to see it as a fun game for myself and for them, something pleasurable to look back. And I just say, so what is the plot? What's happening? Can anybody tell me? But I think maybe as a reader approaching it for the first time, what I try to tell my students to do, because I do this in any reading assignment, I say, go for the plot. And the tiniest details aren't going to matter. But for instance, if you're reading the Limnos episode and you come to line 721 and it talks about Jason getting off the boat and coming to see Hypsipyle, and then there's like 50 lines of narration about his clothes that he's wearing that Athena made him.
Right.
I wouldn't say that that's not important, but understanding this description of Jason's cloak, which we call an ekphrasis, so a description of physical art that's been put into literary form in words. It's not that that's not important to the poem, but you can't really do much with it if you don't have the plot first. So it becomes this process of, let's figure out the plot, and then we can go back and look again and read through the description of the scenes on the cloak and then try to put them together and ask the question, what does this have to do with the rest of the poem?
Absolutely. And I think that's a really good lesson for not only students, but for everybody. There are different kinds of reading. There isn't like one ideal version of reading and all the other ways of reading somehow fall short of that. So there's a kind of initial reading where you're looking for the plot. Then there are later kinds or different kinds of reading where you're focused more on details that you're integrating with that plot. And I think that that can come in handy, not just for our students doing their reading. What is my goal with this reading assignment? Why am I reading this? What am I trying to get out of this? And then tailoring your approach to the reading accordingly. I think that's also really helpful for anybody who's feeling overwhelmed by the amount of information that's coming into their life. Why am I trying to take this information in? What is my goal in reading this news story or whatever it is? And just having an idea of what you're doing with the material, I think, can be incredibly helpful. It seems so basic, but so often we just feel obligated to take in content because it's in front of us and we don't ask ourselves, how is this helping me? What am I trying to do with this? What is my goal with my interaction with this source? And it sounds like you're really helping your students to think about different ways of interacting with the source material, and that different ways of interaction and different sort of, you know, desires for different kinds of pleasure of reading. I think too often our students think that reading is a chore, and helping them to think of rereading as something that's both important and pleasurable, I think, is a wonderful contribution to make to kind of broadening their horizons to think about reading itself in new ways. And I think Apollonius would love that because he's so interested in narrative and narration that I think he would be thrilled with the idea that you're using his poem to help your students be better readers. He would think that was fantastic.
And, you know, one thing that makes me think of is something some of my students have gotten excited about is when they see a tiny detail in one of the books we've read and they didn't think it was important, and then all of a sudden we see it again and it adds new importance. So for instance, I think, Dr. Beck, you've written an article on tris men, tris de, this Homeric formula where somebody tries to do something three times and three times fails, and then the fourth time succeeds or doesn't. I mentioned this to my students, and then lo and behold, in book three, there's a scene where Medea tries to do something three times and three times fails. And one of my students was just like, you said to look out for the three time thing, and we saw it, and then we saw it again. And so it becomes this fun bit of the game isn't to understand everything all at once or to go fast, but to be slow and look back and notice what seem like tiny details can actually add a lot to one's reading and a lot of pleasure.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
For sure. The pleasure of the tiny detail without making students feel tyrannized over by the tiny detail, I think, is as good a way of, as any of summarizing the kind of reading that we're often doing with our students, and that we hope that this podcast series will enable listeners to have for themselves. So that was really fun, Bill. I learned a lot from the things that you said about the Lemnian women. In our next episode, we're going to talk about book two, and I'm going to be joined by Rebecca Vanderhorst, who is a recent graduate of the UT Classics program. And so we hope that you'll join us then. Just as a reminder, the episodes in this season are more interdependent on one another than in the previous season. So we recommend that you listen to each episode in order, but you don't have to do that. Each episode is supposed to be understandable on its own, but they'll be richer and make more sense if you start with episode one and continue through to the end. So thank you again, Bill. Thank you to our listeners. We hope that if you like our podcast, you'll leave us a review or leave us a comment to help other readers or other listeners. That's a fun confusion that I think Apollonius would appreciate. Yes. To help our listeners find our podcast, we'd really appreciate it. Thanks very much. And thanks again, Bill. That was great.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.